This time of year, you're going to find me jigging for crappies off my father-in-law's boat, celebrating a successful turkey hunt, or just sitting on the back deck watching time go by with a quality cigar from Thompson Cigar. Thompson Cigar has been around since 1915, offering the widest array of cigars and cigar accessories at very affordable prices. Thompson Cigar offers your favorite brands like Swisher Sweets, Cohiba, Backwoods, and Monte Cristo shipped fresh directly to your door. Also, be sure to check out their 5-pack fever deals and join their value club for big savings. Visit thompsoncigar.com and enter the discount code SE at checkout for 20% off of all orders over $75. Thompson Cigar, quality cigars at affordable prices.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, brought to you by Full Sneak Gear. Check out their entire lineup at fullsneakgear.com. Also, be sure to check out our entire stable of podcasts at sportsmansempire.com. This episode of the Sportsman's Empire is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. Since 1952, Interstate Batteries has been evoking compassion and a trustworthy spirit into the surrounding communities. Interstate Batteries is a mission-driven company fueled by purpose and guided by their values. If you need help locating a specific battery, stop into your local Interstate Batteries retail store and speak with a battery specialist. They even offer cell phone repairs. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
Two Good & Co. coffee creamers are made with farm-fresh cream, real milk, and contain 3 grams of sugar per serving. That's 40% less than the 5 grams per serving in leading traditional coffee creamers for a rich, delicious experience. Whether you enjoy your coffee hot, cold, bold, or frothy, Two Good coffee creamers make every sip a good one. Two Good coffee creamers, real goodness in every sip. Find them at your local Kroger in the creamer aisle.
Where's your playlist taking you? Down the highway? To the mountains? Or just into daydream mode while you're stuck in traffic? With over 4,000 hotels worldwide, Best Western is there to help you make the most of your getaway. Wherever that is. Because the only thing better than a great playlist is a great trip. Life's the trip. Make the most of it at Best Western. Book direct and save at bestwestern.com.
What's up, everyone? Welcome to the Wing and Tail Boys podcast, your Northeast hunting and fishing destination. I'm Chris.
And I'm Angelo.
And we're your hosts. Join us as we navigate the woods and waters of the Northeast, sharing our passion for the outdoors.
Whether it's land management, outdoor recreation, hunting, or fishing, we're going to cover it all. With 40 plus years of experience in the Northeast, we'll provide insights, tips, and stories to help you make the most of your adventures and help you experience the wild.
So, tune in, grab your gear, and let's hit the woods together. And always remember, success is just a commitment away. What's going on, guys? Welcome to another episode of the Wing and Tail Boys. Thank you so much for joining us today. On today's episode, we are going to be continuing the Science of Arrow Flight series. We're joined again by Dorge of Fire Knock today. And our main goal of today's episode finally is to start breaking down some of the components that go into building an arrow. The last 3 or so episodes, we broke down the main, most important component, which is the base component of all builds, which are all of the arrow shafts. We focused on the 246, why it's considered the standards, the standard, the pros and the cons of the 246. Then we moved into the 300 diameter arrows and larger, and talked about really the benefits of that, because there really aren't many negatives other than components to the 300 diameter class arrow. After that, we went down to the 204 and even further to the 166 diameter arrows. And hopefully we opened our listeners' eyes to some of the downfalls that come with a smaller diameter, larger walled arrow. Now, before we get into today's episode, I have some really exciting updates for the listeners moving forward. We got some really big things coming from the Wing and Tail Boys here and Wing and Tail Outdoors as a whole. First up is I'm finally getting around to designing and launching our website. I just started doing this weekend. It's coming along pretty well. I'm trying to get some things sorted out first. Hopefully in the next week or so, I could become a certified dealer with Fire Knock. And if and when that happens, hopefully I have that website ready to launch there. Also, today is February 19th. And for those of you who are in the Northeast, following the TAC archery event, today opened registration for the Vermont TAC over at Killington, Vermont. And the Wing and Tail Boys are going to be there. We are so excited. And our plan right now is to actually camp out in the parking lot and have like our own little tent out there and kind of just bullshit and tailgate it and maybe interview some listeners and stuff while we're at the event. So that's going to be really, really, really exciting. And the last thing, the big important thing is this Science of Arrows series. This goes hand in hand with what's going to be coming on the website. On the website, everything that we've been talking about here, I'm going to have a page dedicated to the science of arrow flight. What are the flaws with arrows? What are the flaws in flight? What can we do to improve them? So keep an eye out for that. I'll keep you guys updated. Actually, by the time this episode airs, there's a good chance that that website might actually be up and running because I'm a few weeks ahead with recording, you know, so hopefully all of these things that we've been bringing you guys throughout the months, you've been finding some value in that. And with that value is going to come this website. And on that website, like I said, we're going to have the Science of Arrow Flight series. There's going to be some merchandise on there, some like Wing and Tail Outdoors merchandise. There's going to be a special surprise on there that I am not ready to divulge yet. And last but not least, there's going to be a section on there for the Wing and Tail Forest Management sector of the Wing and Tail Outdoors. And as I've mentioned on the podcast in the past, that Wing and Tail Forest Management is intended for, at least right now, I'm a certified herbicide applicator in the state of New York. I'm licensed, I have my insurance, and I'm booking customers for the 2025 spring and summer. Right now, my main goals are to help with TSI work, hack and squirt, spraying herbicides, taking care of your ferns, anything that's invasive or undesired that you just don't have the time, money, or energy to go out and take care of. Reach out to me, wingandtail.chris@gmail.com. Schedule a consultation with me and let's get the ball rolling. Let's get you on the schedule and let's get your property ready to go for the future. The best time to do any work is yesterday. So let's get rolling on that. Again, if you guys like what you've been hearing, go ahead, leave a review down below. Ask us questions, leave us comments. We really love to interact with our listeners. If you like what you hear, share it with a friend. And without further ado, I'm going to introduce Dor Chuang of Fire Knock once again. How are you doing today, buddy?
I'm doing quite well. Okay, how are you?
I'm doing very well. Like, I am super stoked because we're finally getting into like, we're finally getting into the content that I just have not been, I haven't been able to wait to get into. We kind of got, you know, you can't talk about now without learning about the past.
Exactly. Right? I mean, that's the reason I was so concerned with the shaft size, the insert, I mean, the knock. Now exactly. We're talking one of the few components left on the arrow shaft.
Right.
The feathers.
The feathers. So the cool thing is we've been, not that we've been negative, because we're trying to be, you know, we're trying to give information, we're trying to be informative. But the truth is, we've talked about material since the beginning of time, like how arrows were made. We've talked about what happens to an arrow in flight and how it negatively affects your arrow's efficiency. And then we kind of talked smack on all of the arrow diameters and what's wrong with all the arrows. But without pointing out the issues with arrows today, the listeners can't find the value in the components, whether they're fire knock components or not. They can't find value in these components that are designed to help arrow flight without understanding how arrow flight is harmed in the first place. So now, like you said, like we mentioned earlier, we're getting into the feathers, the vanes, the wings, the steering, the rudders, whatever you want to call them. They're the little things that go on the back of your arrow that control, that help control arrow flight, or so people may think.
Correct. So, and not to mention, in some cases, you're better off without vanes.
Which honestly is kind of crazy to think about, because all our lives, it's been drilled into us. You can't shoot an arrow without vanes. You need to steer the arrow. The arrow needs control. It gets controlled from the rear. So let's take a step back. And I know that you wanted to start with the history of vanes, why they were created, what their purpose is, and what they're supposed to do for an arrow. So let's start with the history. What's the history of arrow vanes?
Well, first of all, you need to understand in the old, really, really old days, projectile have basically three forms. You got your spear, I mean, I'm talking throwing projectiles. You basically have three forms, and the three major forms are your spear, your tail engage, what you call a bolt, and finally, your bow and arrow archery projectiles. The first spear, as you know, pretty much the front is heavy, and you got a stick, and the stick oscillate in the middle, and that's your spear. Do you know the most efficient projectile is a rear holding bolt?
Really? When you say a rear holding bolt, is that just basically a bolt that you hold from the back?
No, it's a piece of stick go on the back, and the back holds the bolt. And when you throw it this way, the bolt go forward with no veins, no nothing. Yes, you can put a vein on it. That is one of the most efficient projectile throwing projectile which human have made.
That's interesting. So I have seen them, and they're usually like, you usually see them in like, you know, history documentaries and stuff like that.
Yep.
And it's almost like if anybody has ever thrown clays, like clay birds, when you go to the clay range, mm-hmm. and you use the hand clay thrower to throw the clays.
Yep. It's very kind much of the like same. That, but you hold it back, and then when you go down, throw it up with the back holding. Right. The reason for that, because you're not holding in the middle. When you throw a spear, it's the friction between your hand and the spear. With that, it's pushing from the back, very much like an arrow.
Or more likely, since we're talking about a bolt, like a crossbow.
Exactly. It's a true bolt. Cool. And of course, we have the veins. We have the archery. Now, when you understand archery, from the beginning, people usually just put feathers. Because at that moment, that is considered one of the lightest material. The one that we saw bird flies. A lot of us put feather on it. Feather is really a great material. Feather is one of the best material in so many ways, except for one downside with modern archery. It doesn't really work over 260 feet per second. You can put it on a faster bow, just like, how would I say it? Imagine you're flying, you're driving anything. The fenders and everything would not have much effect until you reach a certain speed, because there's no aerodynamic coefficient or influence by it. But in case of feather, the fact is that if you go over about 260, 50 feet per second, or sometimes as low as 220 feet per second, based on the feather material, the feather have technically zero effect on arrow control. Well, actually, I learned it when I was talking with Silver Fling Marcus. I asked him, how come he used feather exclusively? He said, because he has so much control over it. Then I learned the guy shoot the arrow never over 250 feet per second. Because he was shooting Africa big games. And for him, directional control is critical. And he is not shooting fast bows. When I say fast bow, anything over 270 feet per second, in my reference, is considered fast bow.
Mm-hmm. And it makes sense. That makes sense why feathers are really popular today in archers that are going for high FOC builds. I've seen that a lot. A, because three feathers weigh less than most single veins, but they also seem, this makes sense now, there aren't very many people shooting heavy arrows, high FOC, that are shooting over 250 feet per second. So it makes sense that the feathers would work in that situation.
Yeah, but do you notice one major factor? Why would you shoot over 270 feet per second? Feather technically have no effect on it.
Is it because they're not rigid enough and they just...
No, it collapsed. It just floated flat. So now you got three flat pieces. Keep going and going and going until you drop around 260. Then the feather will slowly rise up.
Now, will that cause... When that happens and the feathers collapse on themselves, does that cause the broadhead to take over the steering of the arrow?
The broadhead is the front. It always steer, no matter what.
Gotcha. There's another misconception about veins then. You know, I was always under the impression that the vein is what steered the arrow.
No, broadhead always give you direction because the broadhead, first of all, is the frontal part of the arrow. It is all about speed and also the directional control of the arrow shaft itself. So, you see, if you got a heavy, heavy FOC, you got a soft spine. Even with the case that a lot of people will have good result with feather, because the feather will be flapping like this. But while it was doing all the in irregular direction, guess what? The speed is so high, the feather collapsed. Mm. So it's nothing more than a shaft with some nubs on it, not veins. Right.
Yeah.
No, so the effect of the arrow become all controlled by the leading, front of center, going the direction you want. While the arrow may go like this, but the effect is minimum because the vanes are collapsed.
Well, that's a really interesting concept because in my
head, it's not a concept. I mean, I can see it on high speed. That's why.
Yeah. What I'm trying to wrap my head around, I guess you could say, is I was always taught that if you shoot a broadhead without vanes on your arrow, the arrow is going to do a somersault and the broadheads are going to end up in the back of the arrow. So my question is
only if your front of center is not enough.
If you have high front of center, the vanes have less of an effect on what you're doing. But if your arrow is more balanced and you don't have vanes, that is what's going to tip it because the balance point is farther back.
Or the drag of the vane is so severe and the front of center cannot overtake it. It's like one incident I'll share with you. I was hunting in Martinos. I was hunting with the quick spin, the original 4-inch quick spin. And I have 85 grain broadheads. It was heavy wind. My arrow go towards the deer and hit it sideways.
I'd be so mad. No,
well, because see, my FOC is not enough. The vane is dragging and the wind is blowing. And with a quick spin, quick spin with the crosswind signature of so high. You actually imagine, you see, technically, you imagine the shape of the air cone. It's narrow in the front and then ginormous in the back. When the wind is blowing, the ginormous part take over, then the arrow will flip.
That makes sense.
Okay, let me introduce you another term, because I'm moving very fast.
Yep.
You shoot fast. Okay, we all know, I mean, let's stop at feathers, and then we'll move forward. Before I go into all the details of aerodynamics first.
My only question, just to clarify, because we've said crosswind signature. Without going into the science behind it, because I know we're going to get into it later in this episode. The crosswind signature, as I understand it, is essentially how much of the crosswind is affected by your arrow or vice versa. How much of your arrow or how do I explain it?
How big is the column of air affected by the arrow when it passes?
There it is. I couldn't put words to what I was trying to say.
Reversed. In other words, the easiest way to think crosswind signature is that when you blow your hand like this, does your hand ever touch your face? Mm. It does not. Well, guess what? You feel the wind. How far does the wind affect in order to touch your face? That's from this point to this point. That's your crosswind effect. In other words, imagine as an arrow goes through the air. How big a column of air does that arrow actually interfere with?
Okay, that makes sense. And you could think about like a box fan too, like how far from a box fan can you stand and still feel the...
Or simply how far, if the box fan don't have a box, what's the width of that fan when it goes out sideways? That's gotcha. What you're dealing with.
Okay, cool. More than enough for now. We're going to get into
We talk about feathers. So yes. Technical feather is great as long as you don't pass 200, say 60, 70 feet per second. Then we have plastic. Plastic is a great material. It's very durable. It's easier to, I mean, if you use preparation right, it's easy to glue on. And you can make it any shape you want, and it's cheap. And it's very extremely consistent if you do it consistently. 90% of the vane in the market are what you call extruded vane. Let me explain to you what extrusion vane means. That means you've got a shape of the cross-section of the vane, and you'll go through extrusion process, and then they die cut it. They cut the shape of that vane.
So basically, like, just to paint a picture.
It's like a pasta.
Almost like a loaf of bread, and then they're just cutting slices out of that loaf of bread.
No. They cut the vein in the cross-section of a vein shape, and then die cut the shape this way.
Okay. All right.
So in other words, it's exactly like pasta. So you've got a pasta flat coming out, and then you cut it the shape you want.
Like a cookie cutter, roll-out cookie.
Correct. The die cutter is cutting the extrusion to form the vein.
All right.
One of the benefits of it is extremely cheap.
Mm-hmm.
If you use a roller die cutter and so on, you can literally, we're talking thousand, if not, of vanes per second. Mm-hmm. Rolling cutter, fit through it, and then vein just fly out. So it's cheap. What other benefit does it have? Nothing but cheap.
I'm going to assume nothing. If you're asking the question.
Yep, because see, when you die cut extrude, what are the biggest downside with die cut extrusion?
Does it have something to do with, depending on how long of a sheet, I guess you could say, is coming out?
No, it depends on the pressure of the extrusion. Mm-hmm. As you increase it, the material density goes on temperature, the die cut, when the sheet comes out, the cross section of the vein comes out, you cannot guarantee the density of that vein, which now you have two problems. You have now, you cannot control the rigidity of it. And second, you cannot control the weight of it.
Can't control the rigid. So you can't control how rigid it is, and you can't control how heavy each individual vein
correct.
Is.
Correct. And that's the reason. I mean, based on my last testing on, I bought a 1,000 pack of Blazer white. The lightest is 4.2 grain. The heavier is 6.7 grain.
All right.
That's more than 50% variance in weight.
I'm going to put you on the spot here. See if you have this off the top of your head. If somebody asked you, what vein has the most tight tolerances as far as weight is concerned outside of fire knock?
It used to be Vintec, because they have a very good blending of the extrusion process. But then just remember, when you buy Blazer, just because of white, remember, we talk about white Blazer. The white Blazer is not same as the yellow Blazer. It's not same as the orange Blazer. It's not same as the American flag Blazer. And sure, it's not the same as a Tiger Bar-based Blazer. Because you added color, you added heat transfer paint, you also added surface disturbance. Those are not flat.
Gotcha.
That's the reason if you, and then on top of that, every single vein in the market, since it's a die cut, okay? The bottom of the vein feet are always flat.
Which means they don't hug the arrow shaft. They don't match the curvature of the arrow shaft.
None of the veins will match the curvature of an arrow shaft.
Which I'm assuming causes problems with the gluing process.
Yes and no. It's simply how wide it is. When I was designing arrow vein, one of the biggest issues is how the feet of the vein is. Mm-hmm. As a die cut process, the edge of the feet are always the hardest. Which means that it don't conform to an arc.
Yeah, that makes sense. We've all had veins lift off of our arrows at some point or another.
That's the reason people put glue in the front of the vein, the back of the vein, tip on the tip in the front, tip in the back, and then try their best to glue it, to hold it, and so on. But that is one of the design characteristics. So currently in the market, I understand it's original. The quick spin is a molded vein. Okay, let's keep going and source. Right here, talk about the extrusion process.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're really concerned and you shoot higher speed arrow and you like Blazer type vein, what's the most important thing you should do?
If you
weight them.
Like a weight match them, you know, per batch of arrows.
Right. Make weight them, match them within a grain. You'll have much better control if you shoot over 315 feet per second. Because at 315 feet per second, a lot of things going to happen. And your weight balancing of your vein and so on. I mean, just like I remember the fact is that when Tim Gillingham was talking to me back in 2007 about VeinTech, he told me that arrow vein have no benefit over VeinTech if you flush everything straight. I tend to disagree with him, but I understand where he come from. Is that if you are perfectly formed, you're able to launch your arrow as perfect as you can be, the vein have very little effect. The fact is that you don't want the vein have any effect. Because whatever it does is give you more control. And more control means more friction, more loss of energy, more whatever, including crosswind. So if you are a perfect shooter, you really don't need veins. Unfortunately, mm-hmm. we are not. I mean, very few of us are, and not to mention when the situation arises, say under, say, 10 miles per hour wind in most cases, the issue is not that big. And a lot of people focus, oh, I only shoot 270 feet per second. And this time I hunt, the arrow don't fly right. I say, do you remember if you are shooting at, say, 270 feet per second, the wind is going towards you, your arrow is already past 290 in airspeed.
Oh, that makes sense. I never thought of that. Guys, I don't know if you just picked up on what Dorch just said. What he said is if your arrow shoots 270 miles an hour or feet per second, and you have a wind coming to you, a face wind coming at you at 20 feet per second, your arrow is now behaving the way it would if it was shooting out of your bow 290 feet per second on a calm day.
Exactly.
These are the kinds of things that I never would have thought about. And then the second you say them, I'm like, that just makes perfect sense. So I have another question for you, and this might sound like a silly question, but I've heard very often that the only reason you need veins on your arrows is to correct your flaws as a shooter. So
yeah, we'll correct some.
Yeah,
but in some cases, I mean, it's just like tires. Tire will correct mm-hmm. some flaws. Aren't you better on rails? Answer is mm-hmm. yes, but you can't be on rails all the time. So yeah. We have tires. And then why do we need rubber tires compared to wood tires? Because the roads are not very perfect. So we need rubber tires to compensate. Same thing with veins. The more perfect the row, the less tire you need.
So my question is, something isn't, I guess, clicking in my brain in the sense of an arrow is going to go where you point it, right?
Mm-hmm.
So my thing is, what flaws of a shooter can veins correct? Like if I'm aiming here and I release by accident this way, obviously my arrow is not going to correct to where I wanted it to go. So what flaws as a shooter do veins actually compensate for?
And in the old days, especially on older compound bow that's not highlight off, it helped a lot more. First of all, it corrects the direction of the arrow because you've got drag on the back, weight in the front, it's going one direction. It's like doing a honey car parachute comes out. It prevents the car going all the way and then going to the yard.
Yeah. So is it safe to say, I'm sorry, go ahead. Go ahead, finish. Is it safe to say then that the veins more so compensate for a poorly tuned bow or a poorly tuned arrow versus a poorly executed shot release?
Is that all of the above?
Okay.
But then that also created another problem.
If you're anything like me, you love to customize your bow while always making sure everything is just spot on. That's why I trust Anthony and Chris over at Big D Custom Pro Shop. They're located on Route 15 in Lake Pacon, New Jersey, and they have everything you need to tune your bow. And I promise you, you're going to leave there with a smile on your face. So if you live in northern New Jersey, give my boy Big D a shout for all your archery needs. When I head out to the woods, I have to know that I have the best performing equipment that I can afford. So that way I'm the only variable that I have to worry about. That's why I trust FireKnock products for all my arrow and bow accessory needs. From arrow components to bow accessories like stabilizers and arrow rests, they have what you need. Dorge won't put anything on the market if it doesn't perform 50% better than what's already out there. So head on over to FireKnock.com today to see what they're all about.
Is that as your speed increases, the veins now, instead of helping, create issues. So that's the reason. The moment you go high speed, over 280 feet per second, nothing helps you. Everything deters you from doing accurate and comfortable and good. So when we finally able to shoot over 300 feet per second, or in crossbow cases, what part of the arrow is helping? Your answer is none of the above. Because if you don't do anything right, that thing is not going anywhere you want it.
And the faster you go, the worse it's going to be.
Correct.
Now, you know, I mentioned earlier in this episode that I'm working towards becoming a certified dealer for FireKnock. Mm-hmm. And in that video process, the lectures that you have, something in there really blew my mind. And I never heard this before. A lot of people, and if you want to touch on this later, just let me know and we'll shelf it for later in the conversation. But there was something in there where we started to talk about offset and helical.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of archers or arrow builders that do this stuff at home, and it makes sense. The more offset, the more drag, the more rotation. Mm-hmm. But
Theoretically.
But what blew mm-hmm. my mind is you had mentioned in those videos that the faster an arrow travels, once it passes a certain speed, faster actually causes less rotation, not more.
Correct.
And to me, that blew my mind because it's just not what we've always heard. Would you like
remember, to touch on that? You need to deal with drag. Drag is a force. When you exceed a certain force, it's not helping you. It's slowing you down. And on top of that, every single vein on the world, which is in... have the moment you pass a certain speed, the seven stages of airfoil behavior that is not solid all happened. Fluttering.
I'm sorry, what was that? You said
when you reach a certain speed, okay, the imperfect form of a flat surface all appeared. Gotcha. The number one problem is fluttering. The mm-hmm. vein gets very, very loud. The vein behaves like a whistle. Imagine you just hold a piece of paper and blow on it. That's your vein. What you're making? You're making a freaking whistle.
We've all pulled blades of grass off the ground when we were kids and put them together and, you know, blew into them and made that whistling. Oh, and that makes sense. Anything, like literally anything at high speeds end up fluttering. You take a regular car that's not made, like you take a box truck and go down the road too fast, the entire trailer on that box truck is going to be vibrating and fluttering as you're going down the road. So these aren't physics of just arrow flight that we're touching.
We're talking aerodynamics. That's exactly. And not to mention surface pressure, boundary layer separation, boundary layer issues. And then when you look at most of the veins, you got your, when you look at the vein, it's a delta. And then the backside is a lambda. Now you're looking at the entire aerodynamics on high-speed airplane, your delta and lambda issues. And then you've got your surface texturing issues, your boundary layer separation issue. And to make things worse, it's a flat surface. What happened to flat surface? It creates the humongous amount of sound and drag.
Yeah.
And it will try itself to deform. While in the process of deform, it makes flutters, which is sound.
Well, look at airplane wings. Airplane wings aren't boxes or rectangles. They're rounded in the front. They're slightly tapered from front to back, right? And a plane is going faster than an arrow, you know? So, like, a plane needs to be designed that way to fly through the air properly. And the wings of a plane are what control the plane.
Not just that, you also have lift with it. And then, of course, with the research that Professor Salele of Stanford University helped, and also a simple aerodynamics characteristic, you'll find out that there's so many things wrong with vanes. And that, let me point out, the moment you pass 270 feet per second, the more you hit a coast you get, the slower it turns, the more turns. Remember, the word slow and fast is misused. More rotation you got or less rotation you got.
Yes.
So under 270 feet per second, you can go crazy with everything. All of them are pretty straight. If you put more helico, you have more rotation and everything is right. But the moment you pass 280 feet per second, the heavier the helico, the less the arrow will turn because it goes into a fluttering, a stalling.
Mm-hmm.
Stalling is defined as the air is now causing the entire projectile to not go up or down, just stays.
Yeah. And that goes hand in hand with the old adage that everybody's heard, too much of a good thing becomes a bad thing if you're not equipped for it.
Correct. Just like, imagine this, if you want to go down a highway really, really fast and you happen to say the Ford F-350, I don't care how many horsepower you got, I will winch you with, say, a new Honda Accord with the aero package with less energy because aerodynamics is that big a deal. Remember, we were talking 780 miles per hour. Your aero at 280 feet per second is traveling close to 200 miles per hour.
Yeah. And we've talked in the past, Formula One race cars, you know, they're literally designed to be the fastest vehicles in the world. And 80% of their horsepower and engine output literally only goes to pushing air out of the way, aerodynamics.
Actually, so, control. That's the reason, you know, even under the car, the flat surface, a few fairings, guess what? Yeah. That is the equivalent. If you take that away, you had to find 30 or 40% more horsepower to overcome that.
Yeah. And just one more analogy to kind of bring this, because this is so important, because we're always trying to figure out how to get our arrows to go faster, how to get our arrows to be under more control. So it's really important that the listeners understand this concept. Every single person who is listening to this podcast at one point or another has driven down the road and put their hand out the window and done one of these, right? And what happens? The faster you go, the more your hand wants to get pulled up or down or left or right, however you're doing it. But what happens when you just keep your hand perfectly straight? It just cuts right through the air.
Yeah, but right? Remember, your hand is not flat.
It's not flat at all. Exactly. It's tapered from your palm to your fingertips.
And then not to mention your flat surface, there's surface on it. There's texture in it.
Mm-hmm.
If you put a piece of, if you hold up, say, a small board and put it outside the plane, you won't be able to hold it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because that board is going to try its best to do this.
Exactly. And very, very quickly. You know, again, look at motorcycles. Motorcycles are designed to be slim, cut through the air, right? But everyone who's driven too fast on a motorcycle knows what speed wobble is.
Yes. And not to mention, imagine you driving a motorcycle without fairings in the front.
Yeah. Good luck.
You can do that on a Hawk, but not on a Yamaha at 120 miles per hour.
Yeah, exactly. So I think we've touched on the importance of the aerodynamics and why it's so important. But what's really cool is, I'm going back to what I touched on earlier, how the more helical, the faster you go, the slower or the less rotation that you have. Mm-hmm. Now, the cool thing is if I'm not mistaken, it's due to opposing forces. Yes. On one side of the vane, you're getting a rotational force.
You're forcing the entire arrow to rotate through drag.
And on the other, you're getting rotational drag.
Correct.
So can you talk on that for a little bit? How,
well, let me go back to make things even worse, okay?
Oh, boy.
Say you're shooting 300 feet per second.
Yeah.
You have 15% FOC. Where do you think your vane is when you shoot it?
On release?
After the knock left the bow 3 or 4 inch in front of the bow.
I would imagine that your vanes are not in line with the head of the broad, with the tip of your arrow.
Correct. I mean, if you look at a lot of videos that people shoot with a lightened arc, when you shot it, that lightened arc is actually can be as much as 10 inch from the center of your bow. Left, right, up, down. Left, right, up, down. Just like that. All over the place.
That's incredible.
If the lightened arc is there, where's your veins?
Right in front of it.
Right. So the veins can be as much as 9 inch away from the center. And what's the angle of the vein now to the front? Your arrow is like this. The veins are here.
Mm-hmm.
The veins are doing absolutely nothing to steer.
And your arrow's fighting the air more to straighten itself out, which I would imagine loses some energy.
Your parasitic loss is dramatic because of the vein encounter. Now then, if your speed is under 260, 270, the front of your arrow will slow down. Your entire arrow speed will drop. Your arrow is under control. Everything come back. You're able to shoot an animal.
So is that why when people are trying to, there's a lot of test kits out on the market where, you know, you can order, say, a whole range of field points from 100 to 300 grains, 25 grain increments, let's say. Is the reason, like, as people start, so people will shoot the first one. Okay, my arrow's not flying right. They'll add 25 grains. Okay, my arrow's still not flying right. And they just keep increasing the weight until they say, boom, there it is. My arrow's flying great. Is their arrow really flying better, or are they just simply slowing the arrow down far enough?
Got it.
That it doesn't take effect.
Exactly. The arrow is slow enough that the aerodynamics is no longer as a critical factor.
Okay.
And as like, you know, people say 3 plus 3 plus 3 is 9. So does 1 plus 1 plus 8. But when you change the equation, 1 plus 1 plus 3 is not 9. Five.
So my question then, because we talked about how, you know, if someone's shooting a recurve or a longbow, then high FOC makes sense. It's actually what you want.
Right.
My question then is, if someone is below the 250 feet per second, 240 feet per second, does it make sense for them to shoot high FOC?
High FOC also means lower speed.
Yes.
But then you remember, at the end of the day, the killing of an animal is still a slug force issue. Because see, when you finally reach a speed that's so slow, and there is not enough KE behind the projectile with the knife edge on it, it's not going to cut.
Right. Right. And then the argument would be, well, my arrow's moving slower, but the arrow's faster, so there's going to be more slug force when it gets downrange, and that's a whole nother rabbit hole that we could spend days
well,
on.
Well, actually, that is pretty straightforward, and there's also why so many people with high FOC, high that off, thin arrows, shoot an animal close range, it did not penetrate, because the arrow haven't recovered. And can they recover the animal with a super, super big veins? Answer is no. You make it worse because there's more weight on the back to force the arrow to go sideways.
So then,
until the arrow is reasonably straight, the penetration is not going to be there.
I got you. So then, based on what we talked about last week, because I think we touched on FOC, or not last week, but the last episode of the series, and I think we said the longer distance, the more effective higher FOC becomes then.
Correct, but they also remember, initially, you lose more energy. The parasitic loss of the entire arrow launch cycle caused you to lose more energy. In the case of crossbow, I mean, just use the Raven as a... If you start with 220 KE, and you lost, say, 50% of it, you're still at 110. Does it matter?
No.
But if you start with 45, you start with 40, and you lose, say, 10%, you're down to 36. It may not cut anymore.
And that's why I love the concept of Aero Concept 2.0, which, you know, we've talked about this before. We wouldn't recommend someone shooting Aero Concept 2 until they at least try Aero Concept 1, because the jump from a regular Aero to Aero Concept 2 is so massive. But in my opinion, and based on what we have talked about, it's more about the mass of the arrow and not the FOC. I would rather have a heavy arrow that's shooting straight, and on impact, every single grain of my arrow is pushing into the point rather than all of the weight being in the front and just hoping the arrow comes along for the ride.
Okay, now let me give you an example.
Yes.
I got a very good pro staff lady on my pro staff lady. She should say in Champaign, Illinois. She's the kind of person that vein is not important at all. First of all, her shot is usually under 20 yards, more like 15. She should reasonably heavy FOC. We're talking 14, 15%. Under that condition, you want the least amount of weight from the back of the arrow. You want it pretty much like a boat. So for her, the heavier spine arrow you can find with the heavier FOC you can shoot with would be ideal.
Okay.
So the vein has really no effect.
Right. So that goes to say... Oh, sorry. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Okay, I mean, technically, when you do paper tuning, when do you think your arrow really going to behave badly? In most cases, the first 25 yards is not going to behave that badly as long as your FOC is not ridiculous. Low. Mm-hmm. So can you shoot without vanes? Answer is yes. In most cases, in heavy wind condition, without vanes are actually better. But then your form and so on will have factors. Unfortunately, everything we talk about is all condition and the holistic equipment approach. Any part of it can affect the whole equation. It is like, I think the best part, to imagine I'm talking a person. If a stomach hurts, do you feel like doing everything that day?
No.
It's your stomach, it doesn't affect your brain. Or your arm or your butt hurts, do you feel like working that day? Or one of the better one, the bottom of feet hurts. Do you feel like teaching that day? You may feel like sitting. But it's only a very small part. But then the whole person just no longer optimally functioning. Yeah. I mean, yes, you can sort of work, but do you really feel like working?
Yeah, are you working at your highest potential, essentially?
Yes. In other words, in archery, same thing. If part of your arrow is not in great shape at that speed, based on your equipment, how good do you feel when you release the arrow?
It feels good until you see what it does.
How good do you expect the arrow to behave?
And guys, that really goes to show, like, we started this in the beginning way back, you know, weeks ago, by saying that there isn't one type of arrow build that is going to work for everyone. Some people, it makes sense to shoot high FOC. Some people, it makes sense to shoot as low as possible. Some people, it makes sense to shoot a light arrow, others a heavy arrow. Some a thin arrow, some a thicker arrow. That is why it is so important to get linked up with a quality custom arrow builder. And let me just say, you don't need to spend hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of dollars just because you went to a custom guy. There's guys like, we've talked about X-Ring Customs a lot in the past. He has custom arrows for sale that are $2.
For a whole dozen.
Exactly, for a whole dozen custom built to you as an archer based on your draw length, draw weight, axle to axle, your let off, what you're shooting, how far you're shooting, are you target, are you hunting? We're not asking you to spend hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of dollars. We are just saying that an extra $20 a dozen could get you an arrow.
It might not even be. Right, just like, very simple. If your objective is to try to bring your kids from your house to the school, what's your best vehicle? Answer is that I can't answer the question.
The one that uses the least amount of gas.
No. Because the school being next to you, answer is none.
Mm-hmm.
Because he just walks to school. So until you know the whole situation, when you say, I want the best way for my kids to go to school, and if that's your only question, nobody on earth besides you is able to answer that because nobody knows the entire situation. Exactly. You can say, motorcycle, bicycle, skateboard, walk, all of them are valid until we know the situation. Right. I mean, just like I remember when I was a C4SI consultant, I was in Rawson, North Dakota, talking to a school district. Do you know a few kids actually fly in?
To where? They fly, like what, helicopters?
No, planes.
To school?
Yes.
What?
The school district only have 60-something, 70 people. But you need to remember that in Rawson, North Dakota, it's not a very populated place. Mm-hmm. The only thing I remember is that big, ginormous parish. They got a ginormous concrete Perry chicken statue in front of the town entrance.
That's awesome. That's really cool. That's like the fun facts that you like, you know?
Yeah, I know. So, you know, I was a system optimization consultant. I mean, I got my DBA, I got my CISA, I got my CPA. Those are the fun times.
Yeah.
That's a different life.
Yeah. So we've talked a lot about, you know, not anything that deviates from a straight fletched vein is going to have negative downside once you pass a certain speed.
Offset or helical is not bad. And my answer to that is that if you really want good arrow flight, not more than 1%, 1 degree is usually quite decent at high speed.
Okay.
Anything over 3, you're really asking for it.
Gotcha.
And the longer the vein, the worse it gets.
All right.
And the taller the vein, the more control you get. Mm-hmm. That's about the tip. I mean, we learned that in windmills, the size of the windmill really affect the total output. And in the case of them, you need to think of the veins, not the veins. The moment you pass 287 ADV per second, you need to think of them as flat or curved airfoils. But the fact is that it's not an airfoil because it's flat. Mm-hmm. So it's now like the traditional windmill. As you remember from history class, the moment the wind blows really serious, all the Holland windmill that is basic, they all broke. They all got damaged.
They couldn't handle
because
the
speed they are not an airfoil.
Right.
They can't handle the speed.
Okay.
So and then, the larger they are, the easier they're to break.
Yeah.
Because the force is more dramatic. It's geometrically.
That makes sense.
You remember diameter, circumference?
Oh, yeah, pi, the whole nine.
Yes,
yeah.
Exactly. See, so, I remember that cartoon. The old man is dying. He say, I died without using math for my whole life.
Yeah. How dare he?
Well, you know, I'm not good at math, but I make do.
Listen,
but you need some. I mean, you need to have the basic background. I mean, of course, all the fourth dimensional quadrant geometry will kill me.
Right.
I can't handle
it. We also talked about, you know, the problem with the typical, like the cheap way of making veins, so to speak, is that you can't control the density of the veins, which means, you know, you can't control the weight of each vein. When veins are flat, perfectly flat from the foot of the vein to the top of the vein, they flutter way too much and they don't really do what they're meant to do. Is there anything else about the standard vein that, you know, you can go and pick up at any store? Is there anything else that the listeners should know about them before we move into aero vein? Because that when we start talking about aero vein, it's, in my opinion, outside of aero concept as a whole, I think the veins are so incredible. The way they're designed, the function of them, what they do, I think they're amazing. So is there anything else that the listener should know about other veins before we go into that?
You need to think about in today's bowl, the longer the vein, the worse it is for you. The higher the speed, should be taller the vein, the shorter the vein. Because the fluttering is one of your biggest enemy.
The longer the vein, the more it flutters.
You don't want a vein that's long. You want a vein that's short and tall.
But the problem with tall veins then is you end up with face pressure when you're shooting your bow.
If your veins are too long.
Yeah.
I mean, they make plenty of shape and forms. Mm-hmm. I mean, why am I not happy with long veins? Because long veins give you an unpredictable result in high speed. High speed is defined at over 270 to 280 feet per second.
Is that because they're going through the wind channel for a longer period of time?
No, because the front part of the vein, the midsection of the vein, and the top of the vein, as you elongate it, the different section of the vein will do different things at different speed, at different conditions, and you have no prediction over it.
Okay, that makes sense then. Yeah.
So the shorter you got, the less variance you have. So you have better control. But at the same time, if your aero speed is low, the longer the vein, you have more control. You're increasing total drag surface. Just like I give you 1 inch and put your hand over it, and then 4 inch for your hand over it, the amount of drag surface is significantly increased.
Yes. That makes sense.
But then as your speed increases, the drag surface of a continuous flat surface will create a lot more unpredictable result. That's where the biggest problem is, unpredictable.
And there would be more flutter in there
because the vein now instead of using a single fluttering, you have multiple waves of fluttering, which cause mm-hmm. multiple sound.
Very similar to the way an aero shaft flexes. The longer the shaft, it could be torquing or flexing in a different direction in multiple different sections.
Yes, correct. You got multiple frequencies. So in other words, it's not a single frequency, but multiple. Now, predict it. Answer is that you couldn't.
I got you. So then, with that all being said, building the platform for aero vein.
Aero vein was actually a total new concept, which is patented by me.
Mm-hmm.
I'll tell you a fun story. I was hunting in Volleyball. Right in the entrance where the sign say,
like a hiking trail?
Not a hiking trail. You know, do skiing, off-country skiing.
Oh, yeah, cross-country skiing. I got you.
Cross-country skiing trail. I was sitting in the middle with the left and right apart. I sit right there because that's where the deer come in. It was like 5:30 in the morning. An owl fly like that and landed on this side. Within arm reach, I was looking at it and was looking at me, and then you go, shh. After a while, I'm looking at it and it just go this way and fly away. Mm-hmm. I say, this sucker have no sound. And about 4 weeks before that, I have the Martino incident. The arrow goes sideways and hit the deer. I say, why can't my arrow fly like that?
So like anything else, arrow vein was birthed from an issue that you saw and something that...
An encounter on two issues. The mm-hmm. first arrow vein one is very much like the bi-delta wing. I put airfoil in the front and then another delta on the second one. because I didn't want to make a ginormous long delta wing. It was too complex. I even showed that when I showed that to Professor Salik out of Central Illinois. He's the world premier expert. I mean, there's nobody on this planet that know, as far as I'm concerned, knows more about low-speed airfoil, which is considered anything not over subsonic. He had 120,000 airfoil in his life, last time I heard.
So I'm just gonna we've used the word a lot already. I'm gonna pause you for a second. Could you put into like simple words what exactly an airfoil is?
Airfoil is a piece of material with shape that controls the air that go around it with desired result.
So it's designed in a way that forces the air to behave the way you want it to and to create a reaction between the airfoil and the air.
Correct. In other words, if you look at a wind turbine blade, that's an airfoil. You look at the airplane wing, that's an airfoil. You look at the side of an airplane on the neck, that is a hidden airfoil. Actually, in some cases, that's considered as a vortex generator.
Okay.
So, I mean, anytime you got a shape to control air to a certain extent, it's considered as a aerodynamic control, which, I mean, in some way, the airfoil is also defined as when you pass air through this material, this piece of material passing air can make a directional effect on where that piece is.
So we can control, essentially, an airfoil design allows whatever, like, so let's take an airplane wing, because I think that'll be the easiest one for listeners to understand.
Mm-hmm.
An airplane wing or an airplane doesn't fly because the wings create drag and force the plane to fly. An airplane flies because it creates lift based on the way the air moves around it. And if I'm not mistaken,
the resulting drag is also up there. Very much like a wheel. Remember, when you push a wheel, where's the friction? The friction is helping you, not against you.
Yeah. And it's
in
my
the case of the wing, the lift and the resulting drag is pointing the same direction.
The same direction. So it's my understanding that if I were to break it down to a simple form, an airfoil causes air to move faster over one side of it rather than the other. And that item, that whatever that object is going to move towards wherever the lesser force is.
Correct.
Is that correct?
And then, and not to mention the shape of the airfoil. In ideally, is that we want the shape of the airfoil to change based on need, based on speed, and based on necessity.
So we
this
want
is where
we want. So the airfoil should be designed in a way that it can
change its shape.
It can change it based on the heat, based on the speed, in order for it to do what you need it to do at that speed.
Right. Just like when you sit on an airplane and the airplane to land. What did the airplane wing do? It extend downwards. You want to create more lift.
Okay.
Because now the upper distance and the lower distance, now you want to increase it. So when you increase lift, well, great. But you also induce drag, which slow you down. But you also prevented a low-speed stalling, which the airplane would just drop off the sky.
Yeah, I wouldn't like that.
No, nobody likes that. But then you need to understand, just like when I was talking to Professor Lele out of Stanford University, the aerodynamic elasticity memory effect. Oh, my God, that was such an interesting discussion. Is that, you know, there's so many animals that can do change of shape of airfoils. Hummingbird, the wing is continuous changing shape. Dragonflies, your moth, and of course, the ultimate, the mosquitoes.
Yeah, those damn mosquitoes.
Yes. I mean, they're the ability to change direction and control. Of course, the ultimate flight control is also owned by the dragonfly.
Yeah. So,
but then we can't do any of those, but we can mimic. Remember, dragonfly, when it flies, it's the sound. When bees flies, there's sound. When mosquito fly, there's sound. When fly flies, there's sound. The only fly with no sound is
the owl. Yes. And that's more, and that's not just because of the airfoil. That's because of the shape of the wing and how it passes through the air.
No, the aspect ratio,
right?
It's the frontal section compared to the ratio of the curve and the curvature.
Okay, so it's more of the design of it also.
Correct, because you notice the frontal part of the owl wing is actually much thicker and rounder compared to other, and the tail of the feather is significantly softer.
That's so cool.
When I found that, I was like, "Oh my God! But this is what I did."
The animal kingdom just absolutely blows me away.
We in human are not as smart as multi thousands of years of evolution. And sometimes we need to learn from nature. And this is one of them.
Right. Okay.
And when I learned
Go ahead. When you learned what?
When I learned about how the owl swing actually work and then go into a full aspect ratio of what the owl does, I say, oh my gosh, I just hit all the check marks gold. And then, and of course, I show Professor Selig my first two designs, Arrow Wing 1. Mm-hmm. And then with his help, I designed Arrow Wing 2. And with a really long consultation, I have Arrow Wing 3. Mm-hmm. I no longer sell Arrow Wing 1 because he already told me, Dodge, your Arrow Wing 1, interesting. He was very kind. In other words, you told me that the FR I have is a good concept, but you know, if the result shows good, it's okay. But you really don't do much because it is technically a flat delta wing with the airfoil in the front and they interact with each other sort of okay. And I agree. It's heavy. Mm-hmm. First of all, it's like 7-8 grain each. My course was a 9 grain each. And it's a long airfoil. So it really don't do anything. I mean, if you shoot slow speed, if you shoot about 290, it still worked. Mm-hmm. At 300 feet per second, the stalling on the secondary delta wing is very bad.
Yeah. Now there's something that I want to point out about, because Arrow Concept 1 is, like you said, is discontinued. You don't offer that
anymore. Arrow Vane 1, yes.
Or, I'm sorry, Arrow Vane 1. But there's something really important about Arrow Vane 1 that spawned the creation of the designs for Arrow Concept 2 and 3.
Yeah, and Arrow Vane 2 and 3, yes.
What everybody thinks is something that's smoother is going to pass through the air better, mm-hmm. which is what you thought of when you designed Arrow Vane 1. But what you found is that the smoother surface actually created more drag. Because
yes, actually, I remember the second meeting with Professor Selig. I laid this on his table. I got Arrow Vane 2 firstly made after our first discussion. Now I show him, see, this is Arrow Vane 2 and Arrow Vane 1, version 1.0 for both. Professor Selig keep on moving his hand over the vane like this. I say, you notice I pay extra money to smooth those molds. He looked at me and then he saw a look at me with a smile. You know, golf ball have dimples. I say, but this is not rotating. He said, you know, you have a shark skin texture for boats and also for sail. He said, I think you need a crash also boundary layer separation and surface pressure. I said, holy shit, I think I do.
That's amazing.
Then he showed me two books and I go read it and say, oh my God, I mean, how stupid am I?
Now, to simplify this for the listeners, because this could get really technical with physics and all that stuff, so I'd like to try to keep it as simple as possible. Basically, when you're going through water, the smoother something is, the more the water wants to go to it because it's easier to flow over. Air works the exact same way. Air is going to pass over something smooth faster than it's going to pass over something that's rigid or textured. Well, the problem with that when you're talking about vanes is you want to reduce wind drag, not increase. So when you have a smoother surface, it attracts the air essentially. I know it doesn't technically attract the air, but it makes the air want to pass over.
Not leave.
Yeah, exactly. So one of the really cool things about Arrow Vane is that not only do they have texture, but the texture is zoned. Basically, there's a front section that is the largest section, the middle section, which is the second largest section, and the third section, which is the rear of the vane, which is the smallest section. And each section of those vanes has a different texture pattern.
Yes, why? Those are the one I personally do not know. I simply are devoted to the experts. I say, first say, like, how should I zone it? I say, just separate it in three. I say, just like that's exactly what I did in Arrow Vane 2. Then I find out that he was telling me what to do, and I go ahead and do it, but without being precise. Then I say, mm-hmm. That sounds pretty rough. The vein should be pretty organic. I say, of course, you should do it like this way, and this way. I say, that's not what you said. You say, that's reason Arrow Vane 3. The zones are a lot more organic for that reason. Mm-hmm. Because when he first showed me what it is, I use his idea, and without thinking, I should be, how do I say it? If you don't know, you don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly what happened. I don't know, and I'm incapable at that moment.
Yeah.
Because just like when you go to a subject you really do not know, don't assume anything. Assuming is for idiots. And I was an idiot that day.
I think we've all been caught in there at one point or another. Now, okay. a question for you. I see, because I'm looking just for the viewers, my goal, hopefully I can get around to it before I release this, is I want to put some visuals into this episode for you. So if you're listening on the podcast, you're just going to have to try to picture it. But I really recommend that you go to the YouTube version of this video because I'm really hoping to have some visuals up there with it. Or you go to FireKnox website, it's all there. But if you've now realized that the contoured sections of the vein work better than the vertically split sections, have you had any thoughts of adding the how do I put it?
The multiple texture and the zoning? Answer is no.
Yeah. Have you thought of making it go like this instead of like this?
When I have my arrow vein 1 and 2 first made, I was very thrilled because I go through all this. The top of the vein and the bottom vein, they're different textures and so on, all through aerodynamic. I got a letter from New Archery Product telling me I violated the patent. They own a patent that the left and the right vein have different texture on it. And they know that I went through research. It is not try to violate the patent, except they own the patent to the texture on each surface is not the same. Mm-hmm. So I go ahead and ask them, how about this? I will remake my veins so the texture on each side are 100% identical in different zones. That no longer violates the patent. I appreciate them helping me out because they know it is a pure scientific research. I happen to step on what they have claimed in a patent.
I gotcha.
That itself is how I built mine. Can everything be more efficient? Answer is yes. Different texture on different section and lower section, upper section should be all different to get the best efficient. Mm-hmm. The answer is that because of that patent, I can't do that.
Gotcha. Now, what I was more referring to is, how do I put it? The zones on arrow vein 3
mm-hmm. go that's from significantly front... more advanced than arrow vein 2.
Right. They yes. go front to back, but arrow vein 2 go up and down. Have yes. you ever thought of making the arrow vein 2 the same way, except making those sections go the same way?
Yeah, if I want to feel like spending $40,000 more, answer is yes.
Okay.
And at low speed of arrow vein 2 was what go for, it's not necessary.
I got you. So if someone wants the benefit of arrow vein 2, or I'm sorry, if someone has arrow vein 2 and wants the benefit of arrow vein 3, the only way to get it is to have the higher speeds. And once you have the higher speeds, it's just better to shoot 3 than 2.
Not really. The 3 and 2 have a different capabilities. They are both high-speed veins. The matter of, just like, one is 9, I'll just use something hypothetically. At 97% compared to 98.5%, what difference does it make?
1.8%.
Okay? If you are really doing from a 50% point of view compared to a 97 and 96%, what difference does it make?
From 50% to 96? Mm-hmm. I would think it would make a huge difference.
Yes. That means that the difference between the texturing on arrow vein 2 and arrow vein 3 on formation and so on is insignificant. And as a matter of fact, the arrow vein 2 compared to arrow vein 2 version 2 is a significant degradation of the vein's capability.
All right.
Let me tell you what happened. When I made arrow vein 2 with the 2 texture the first time, the arrow vein is closer to 4.2 grains each because of the lawsuit. I need to grind the surface out and repurchase. I mean, I purchased the remember, in molding, every single texture is a licensing I had to pay. Mm-hmm. So I'm using what I have and redo it on both sides identically. Because when you grind the mold, you make the mold thicker. That means the thinner, which means the arrow vein 2 is thicker than before, mm-hmm. which lower its elasticity capability, which lower its performance. Performance as ability to rotate. By close to 30%. Actually, it's closer to 50% compared to original. But that actually helped me.
Really? Why is that? Because we would think that more rotation is going to stabilize the arrow better. So how is it better that it rotates less?
Okay. Remember we talk about on most arrows, when you shoot it out, how much way it flex all over the place? And if the arrow vein at that moment is trying to do rotation, which way is the arrow shaft going?
We have no idea.
Exactly. And if the rotation is close to, let me put some numbers. A blazer arrow vein, they go at 260 feet per second. You're looking at a blazer can do about 8 to 12. The arrow vein is doing somewhere in about 30 to 50. The arrow vein 3 is only do about 30 to 50. So you're about 3 times. At 300 and 15 feet per second, the blazer is doing about 8 to 12. Arrow vein is doing between 60 to 90. Arrow vein 3 is doing about 6 to 120. At 350 to 400 feet per second, the blazer is doing between 8 to 12, or more like 8 to 10, because rotation speed drop. Arrow vein is doing about 90 to 120. The arrow vein is approaching 280. At 400 feet per second, the blazer is doing about 10. The arrow vein 2 is doing about 100 to 120, and arrow vein 3 is exceeding 300.
That's incredible.
Now, the problem exists. We're not a focal factor of double or triple. In the case of AeroVing 3 over the original AeroVing 2 is very minor. It's maybe 10% difference. Now we're talking 50 to 100, 50 to 200% difference based on speed.
So AeroVing...
No. That's not the right word. AeroVing 3 performed differently from AeroVing 2.
Differently. All right.
Yeah, well, AeroVing 2 at that time, the problem is not rotation. It's too much rotation. So how many broadhead can you able to buy with zero effect when rotating at that speed? That's your problem. By slowing the AeroVing 2 down by 50% or more, AeroVing 2 have all the benefit and nothing of the downside for most people. That's the reason AeroVing 2 is so successful.
So this is going to sound really counterintuitive, but the world wasn't ready for AeroVing 2 when AeroVing 2 came out.
Because see what happened, you said everybody loved it when you were shooting field point. The moment you put a broadhead on it, I mean, it's like everywhere. We're talking, I remember one incident, I was testing the Ramcat Diamondback at 30 yards. The arrow landed about 40 yards left of me, right on me. You just go in.
Yeah, that's so... What's really interesting to me, and I don't know if the listeners caught on to this, but at 260 feet per second, Blazer was doing about 8 to 12 rotations. 115 feet per second, Blazer was doing 8 to 12 rotations. Not per second, I'm sorry, in the first 20 yards.
Mm-hmm.
So at 260 feet per second, 8 to 12 rotations in 20 yards. 115 feet per second, 8 to 12 rotations. 350 to 400 feet per second, 8 to 10 rotations. The speed does not change the amount of rotation per
actually sometimes decreases. That's the reason I want to show you.
So why is it that Blazer doesn't change or decreases and AeroVing continues to increase with speed?
Okay, this is where the magic of airfoil. Because as a vane, it is a wing. As a wing works, what is the wing? I mean, as every single people who just go on an airplane, they all understand. The force of the lift is what keeps the airplane afloat, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so the force the airfoil was against is based on gravity. You're fighting gravity so you can go above the air. Am I right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Okay, when the arrow is turning, you're doing a circular lift. What is it fighting against?
Gravity?
Nothing.
Nothing.
When you're fighting against nothing, what prevents you from doing more of it? Nothing.
Nothing.
The only thing is rotational mass. That's your only resistance to it.
Yeah. And I'll be honest, I have listened to so many podcasts where you talk about this. You and I have had so many conversations about this. And until I saw the diagram yesterday or 2 days ago, whenever I watched this video, it never actually clicked. All of the forces are working in the same direction.
And there's no downside.
Right. When it comes to AeroVing, all of the forces are working in the same direction. And it's the direction the arrow turns.
Mm-hmm.
Which is just incredible, because then the faster it goes, the more those forces increase. And since they're working in the same direction, it causes more of a rotation, not less of a rotation, which is counter to what a typical vane does, because it works off of drag and you have counteracting forces.
Correct. And to make things even more interesting, the reason that I'm able to make AeroVing 2 spin less than AeroVing 3 because it's thicker. That means it's less flexible. Remember, that was a very important term I've used. It's called aerodynamic elasticity memory. When the arrow spinning, the entire airfoil coming through the air is causing the deformation of the vane. That vane is designed with very big help out of Professor Smith out of Auburn University. That foil itself will change its shape to match the required yawn of the vane. So actually that whole vane is going to behave like an impeller, not a propeller, an impeller. And then the yawn and the lift together will find its common point. The optimization of the vane will induce more spin. So that's the reason the AeroVing 3 being a lot softer and a new design compared to AeroVing 2, it's been a lot less compared to AeroVing 2. AeroVing 3 at 350 or 400 feet per second was doing 300 to 215 revolution, while AeroVing 2 is doing 120.
And the 120 is more than enough. And the 120 is more than enough as long as you're using
120 is still more than 10 times of what the other vane does.
100%. Now, You guys can tell how much Dorge loves this because we have done such a good job of staying away from all these scientific terms. And I can see it. You just can't help yourself with this one, you know, but honestly, it's all fascinating. And like I said, guys, yeah, you really need to.
Now let me bring it back. Mm-hmm. When you got an arrow of that speed, that capability, now the question is, can you use arrow wing in low speed? Answer is yes. You can use arrow wing as low as 140 feet per second. Because at that moment, we could force the entire airfoil to be on a helical clamp or an offset clamp. What should we doing? We are forcing the aero wing to behave the airplane is landing as a down flap. We're inducing drag to the extreme, but we also have all the benefit of the airfoil structure of no sound.
Right. Because when a plane is landing, the drag isn't changing. It's not lifting in the opposite direction. It's just lifting less until it reaches.
Because you're increasing the entire airfoil length.
Yeah, that makes sense. Now, someone told me in the past, and I don't know if there's any truth to this, because I was a member of an archery club when I was in New Jersey. And a lot of guys love to shoot long distance. And I showed them AeroVane 3. I had them on my tours that I had built for me last year. And I loved them. But what they were concerned about was the ballooning effect at long distances if their arrows weren't traveling fast enough. Is that a concern people should have?
First of all, you need to understand when you rotate an arrow to a certain extent, the arrow did not go down in an arc anymore. It descend because mm-hmm. the Magnus effect kick in. Your right hand rule, rotation. So mm-hmm. the arrow will now actually rotate so much, it stabilizes itself. The arrow will now descend horizontally.
Yes.
That means you can now shoot an arrow, say, at 150, 200 yards. Just like Jim Burnsworth, he did that on the 315 or 350 yards away over the valley. The arrow hit the target perpendicularly. Every single arrow, if you want to shoot that distance, you come in an extreme angle. But with arrow wing on the back, guess what?
Yeah.
It come down perpendicularly.
And now we're talking, obviously, on the plane of the shot, right? Like, if you shoot at a deer from a tree stand and you're shooting down, it's not going to be horizontal to the ground. It's going to be horizontal to the plane on which you're shooting.
No, actually, the arrow is still cold. As distance increases, the arrow will find itself to be horizontal. That was where the problem is.
Problem? Like, that's a downside of it? Or?
Well, the directional control. That means anytime you push it up, the moment the arrow find a horizontal plane, it will now drop down on it. But when you shoot an arrow like this form, ever the angle it is, the angle will follow. That means if your shooting angle is over 90 degrees, well, over 180 degrees, it will go down to 180 and stop there. If you shoot below 180 to start with, whatever angle, it will follow.
Okay, yeah, that's essentially what I was getting at. Now, this is really important, and we're coming up on an hour and 20, so I think we want to try to start wrapping it up here at some point. Mm-hmm. But this is super important for archers that don't use pin sights.
Oh, we can just talk more about it next time.
Sure. It's really important for those of you who are shooting sights that are not multi-pin sights. If you're using a slider sight, if you're using a, you know, 20 and 30, and then your third pin is a slider. If you're like me and you shoot the Garmin sight, you're going to start to find now that because your arrow is retaining its energy for longer, it's more efficient downrange. It is not falling on an arc, but traveling horizontal to the ground. You are going to find that you're not going to find a sight tape that lines up from zero to however far you're going to shoot.
Based on speed. You end up cutting a few sight tape like I did for most of my customer. I usually cut the sight tape into three sections. Zero to 30, 30 to 60, and 60 onwards. I end up with same three sight tape on it because the arrow behave a difference. See, the whole idea for that is, make it simple, is that your arrow retain more energy, which means that the parasitical loss that we expected from the arrow to decrease is not there, which means the arrow is traveling at a higher distance, as higher speed as distance increases. But that's another factor which I did not expect until I was doing kinetic energy tests. For longer range with a medium-heavy arrow, the total amount of energy delivered to the animal is 8 to 12% more with the arrow compared to others, which took me a while to understand why. It is no longer just speed times weight. Speed and weight. Because arrow is rotating at high speed, it is now a rotational mass, which now it actually is behaving like an energy storage device. The moment you stop the arrow from rotating, energy is also released. So now you understand why I designed broadhead that behave differently, because I want to utilize that energy.
That's incredible. So In my case, with the Garmin sight, it's really convenient because I have the newest one, whatever the new, the A1i, whatever. It doesn't matter. The point is I can go in and say, okay, I can enter manual points rather than asking the site to program my pins. I can program my own pins and then it fills in the gaps in the middle. So yep. I could go in and manually enter 20, 30, 40, 50, 60, 70 until I max out my sight. And then the sight itself will program from 20 to 30 based on what I put in. Then it will put in 20 to 30 to 40, 40 to 50, so on and so forth. So it instead of having to fill in from 0 to 60 and further, it only now has to fill in the gaps that I didn't program.
Well, actually, that's exactly what happened with Garmin and also with the crossbow sight people. I told them they need to add a third factor called aerodynamic efficient factor. Or simply, in other words, what you are doing is that for most people, they will do the 0 to 20 and then give the speed and then expect the projected drop points. That itself is not a linear or projected condition. As you make more points, you're giving the system a better of actual.
Yeah.
That's all it is. Just like when you do math, the more points you get, the closer to the curve you will be of the actual.
That's exactly. So, George, what I'm going to do is I'm going to take 2 minutes. I got to go take a
week. No, actually, we are good. I think we're going to call it for this session because okay. I just noticed it's 4:51 and I need to meet my wife for dinner.
All right. So then in the next episode, do you want to pick back up with this and finish with veins? Because I think because of what the veins cause, I think it's really important that we finish with the veins and go into broadheads. Simply because...
Sure, we can do that. Because we talk about broadhead design and what it have effect. Because remember, everything we talk about is riding on each other.
Right.
Like you can't have a sports car until you talk about tire, steering, handling. And then if everything's said and done, you still need the driver and the guy who put the car together and the fuel.
Exactly. And we touched on this, and it's really important for listeners to know. If you're interested in aero vane, I think it's a great thing. But you also need to understand that aero vane 2, you're slightly limited with what broadheads you can use because of the way they function in the high rotation. And then if you choose to go aero vane 3, you're drastically limited on what broadheads you can use.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
So, yeah. So I think that's why I'm saying I think it's important if we just talked about the vanes, finish with the vanes and go into those broadheads because they
I think next episode I will talk about the target arrow and the hunting arrow. And then with a heavy lift on where the vein do. All right?
That sounds perfect. So, guys, you had it here. I know it's kind of an abrupt stop. You know, normally we kind of ease into the end of these videos, but that's completely okay.
Yeah, we talked about minute 24.
Exactly. We're at an hour and 24 minutes. There's a lot of content. I might even go back and listen to this and decide I want to split this into two on its own. But we'll see what happens when I go through it.
Okay, great.
With that being said, if there's anything that we didn't touch on in this video, ask us the questions or tune in next week the next episode of this series because we're going to finish off this. I still have questions that I need to ask you about Aero Vane 3 because Aero Vane 3 has a really cool design that functions opposite to what people would think it would do.
Exactly.
And I didn't get a chance to talk about that. So,
we're going to talk about Aero Vane 3 next time. I'll talk about the usability and also what you expect.
Exactly.
Okay.
So guys, as always, if you like what you heard today, share it with a buddy, share it with someone. Maybe you can prove them wrong and be like, see, I told you veins don't work as well as you thought they do. Whatever the case may be, we're glad that you joined us again this week. Remember to join us here next week, Thursday, every morning, 5 a.m. Thursdays, our episodes post. And until next week, remember, success is just a commitment away. Have a great week, ladies and gentlemen. Mm-hmm.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.